It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore Midwestern foodways cultivated by immigrant communities over generations in Wisconsin and our neighboring states. You can call in about Midwestern cuisine, past, present, future. The number to join in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Fehrbach is a Chicago-based chef and author of Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine with more than 100 tasty recipes. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning to you, and thanks for having me.
Good morning, and I want to say your ranch dressing from this book is an absolute game changer in our household, so thank you for that.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you got to try it already.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Add a little more dill, a little more onion flakes, and we're good to go. So, you know, I mean, you call the Midwest the most consequential region in the development of American food and drink culture. What makes us a bastion of American cuisine?
A lot of it has to do with our history as the breadbasket. You have the grain belt. The production of wheat and the mills in Minneapolis that have provided flour coast to coast for well more than a century now, a century and a half, as well as the meatpacking industry, which grew up in Chicago, but was also important in towns like St. Louis and Kansas City. And we've shipped meat all over the world, and things like hamburgers and hot dogs, which are considered quintessentially American, actually came out of this industry in the middle of the country.
I thought it was interesting too. I mean, you mentioned the mills in Minneapolis, but you say like Betty Crocker is someone that we should, Betty Crocker cookbooks, we should, are essential for understanding Midwestern food. What do you see there?
Yeah, Midwestern food, but also really American food as a whole, because she had millions of listeners all across the country for her radio show. But she was such an influential author. I mean, my mom cooked out of Big Red, which is what her first cookbook from 1955 is often called, the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook. My mom cooked out of it all the time, well into the 80s. And people all across the country were so... a lot of dishes that became popular in mid-20th century America, or that were popular in mid-20th century America, were influenced heavily by Betty Crocker, as well as our baking arts like cakes and cookies. They really taught people how to use General Mills products, Ashburn Washbury, this mill company that today is... General Mills. They wanted people to learn how to use their products, and they made wheat flour, you know, one of the most important foods in our homes. So extremely important, and really what they were trying to do was sell flour.
What is your criteria for how you included a recipe in this book? How did these recipes get in here?
Well, I think it's important to understand immigrant cuisine versus, you know, say American cuisine in our instance, or Midwestern cuisine, in that immigrants come and they cook dishes that come from their home countries or from their home territories. And they either stay in the instance of something like fried chicken, or they evolve and change, and pizza-like foods. Pizza came from Italy, from both Sicily and the southern part of the boot, but it changed and evolved here in very novel ways. So the way I looked at it to say something was Midwestern or an immigrant cuisine was to say, well, if in the event of an immigrant dish, did it exist here for 90 years or three generations, which is to say the first generation brought it, or the immigrants brought it, the first generation kept it, and their children were still, they were still cooking it for their children, and their children were still enjoying it more or less intact. And I think fried chicken is a classic example of that. Bratwurst are another example of that. But then there's also the case of foods that evolved here in unique ways, which pizza is my favorite example to use of that, because you know, here in the Midwest, certainly in Wisconsin, you have tavern style pizza. We have it here in Chicago also. In Detroit, you have Detroit style pizza. In St. Louis, you have St. Louis style pizza. And there's, you won't find anything like any of these in Italy, although the inspiration for cooking different ingredients on a flat disc of dough certainly did come from Italy. So it's Italian in heritage, but they're distinctively Midwestern dishes. So pizza has only been here really since post-World War II in most places. Chicago and Detroit had pizza as early as the 1920s, but they had older Italian communities. But the rest of the Midwest was really the late 1940s, 1950s was when we started cooking pizza. So it hasn't been around that long, actually, which is hard to believe.
It is, because it's so ingrained in our meals on weeknights. Paul Fehrbach with us as we talk about Midwestern food, author and chef. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Heard from Sarah in Libertyville, Illinois, called and said that they loved the Betty Crocker cookbook as a kid, and their family used it all the time, but only made the baking recipes, so things like muffins and cookies and pies and cakes, and the cookbook was covered in dough and flour, and said that as they got older, they cut the sugar in half and these recipes were much better. What do you make of that sentiment?
That's actually a really good question, but again, they were trying to use products. They were trying to promote products that people would buy on the grocery store shelves. And I think back then, and certainly if you read a lot of the old community cookbooks around the Midwest, which is sort of what was inspiring a lot of Betty Crocker's writing, because her team and their offices at General Mills that would develop these recipes, they were women who cooked in homes in the Midwest. And they had Midwesterners have always had a huge sweet tooth. So a lot of these recipes, they're toothache sweet. And I find this myself when I develop recipes for my restaurant today, that it's almost always, you can cut the sugar in half and it's going to be great, because you're going to push those sweet buttons on your tongue a little bit less. And a lot of the other flavors come forward, which, especially if you're making something like pie, almost any kind of pie, you want to taste the fruit. You don't want to just have sugar taking over everything. So I would definitely agree with that sentiment. And I think it's just because of the sweet tooth that people had back in the 1940s and 50s.
So you say there's a difference between a recipe and a receipt. Can you explain the distinction between the two?
Yeah, so a receipt, the simplest way to think about it is maybe a set of instructions or a method that your grandma would write down that didn't have any measurements in it or very vague measurements in it, to say a teacup of this or a spoon of that, because she wouldn't really need to refer to a specific measurement, because she probably had a spoon that she always used when she cooked to measure things. Or maybe she didn't even measure things.
She was doing it by rote memory.
Yeah, so that would be a receipt, whereas a recipe was a concept that developed by the Boston Cooking School in the 1880s, where you would actually have very specific, you know, quote unquote, scientific measurements for ingredients and very specific recommendations for, like, a receipt might say, bake in a quick oven until brown, whereas a recipe would say, you know, bake in a 350 degree oven and for, you know, 45 minutes until a toothpick inserted in comes out clean.
Paul Fehrbach, Chicago-based chef, author of the new book Midwestern Food, as we dig into modern Midwestern foodways that evolve as people from different cultures settled here over centuries. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's foods through which we here in Wisconsin and all over the Midwest have found identity captured in historical recipes. Chef Paul Fehrbach read old community cookbooks to trace the origins of recipes. His book is called Midwestern Food. And you can be part of this food conversation. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, Wisconsin tailgate staple is the beer brat, and you claim your recipe may be the best sausage out there. What makes it special?
I've actually never seen a sausage cooked this way, and I think it's a really clever technique, but it was the way my dad cooked beer brats, and he says it's the way his dad showed him how to cook beer brats. And you basically put the bratwurst in you have to have a heavy iron skillet, 10 or 12 inches. And so you have to have two beers to do this. You have to have one for the bratwurst, and you have to have one to cook the bratwurst, because if you do it right, it takes you about as long to cook the bratwurst as it does to drink the beer.
Yeah.
You have to start with really good bratwurst. And the best thing about one of the best things about Wisconsin is that you have great bratwurst, because in almost every town you have a great local butcher. Mm-hmm. And so you have to use really good bratwurst from a really good local butcher, because the skin is really important, that casing. So you put the bratwurst in a heavy iron skillet, and you work mostly over medium low heat. You start on kind of high heat, because there's a lot of liquid, and you gradually turn it down as the beer boils away. But you cover the bratwurst with one of the beers, and then you poach it in this beer, but you cook the beer completely out. So you start on high heat and constantly turning the bratwurst, and so that they cook evenly, because that's really important, so that they don't split or pop or anything like that, because you want that casing intact. So you keep turning the bratwurst every 15 seconds or so. And as this beer starts to sort of run down and becomes like lower than halfway up the bratwurst, you start to turn the heat down a little bit, because it's going to get pretty hot. And eventually, you start turning the bratwurst a little more often, and then they're going to start to brown as that beer disappears. And that beer is going to turn into a syrup, which caramelizes on the exterior of the bratwurst and gets really, really crispy and almost charred. Mm. So you have to be turning them constantly to keep the beer coating on them. And as it sort of turns into caramel and then chars a little bit, and then you have to wait a while to eat them, because once they're done, they're really crispy on the outside and really hot, but they pop, and everybody who's had bratwurst knows that a bratwurst can pop, and you got to watch out for that juice. These have really hot molten juice, so you got to let them rest for about 5 or 10 minutes before you eat them, but they're crunchy on the outside and succulent and juicy on the inside and redolent of beer. It's just my favorite way to eat bratwurst.
Oh, it's so hot. Letting that bratwurst rest after you take it out of the pan, that really will test your patience. And we have a link to your beer brat recipe on our program page over at WPR.org/mornings. You can find it there. You mentioned your dad teaching you how to make beer brats. How does food and cooking play into family relationships and in your German heritage?
They were really important. I mean, everything from community. Think of the opening of the barbecue chapter. I talk about we called them pig roasts. We didn't, in the Midwest, they weren't called barbecues, at least not back in the day, where everyone gathered around a pig rotating on a spit. Two things like my dad showing me how to make a bratwurst. Mom made this dessert called Cherry Delight. The recipe's in the book, and people should actually absolutely make that recipe. It's fabulous.
With Michigan cherries.
Exactly,
or Door County.
You got some pretty good cherries up there in Door County last
week. Equal opportunity there.
Yeah. So, I mean, all of these things are the family just sort of obviously is part of everyday life, and food is part of everyday life. And so recipes become something that sort of ties the web of life together. And that includes family and friends and community.
We're talking about Midwestern food with author and chef Paul Feuerbach, and you can join in along the way. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I just felt such kinship with you, Paul, as you went down into your grandmother's cellar and saw so many lines of pickled things and other things just lining shelves. I have German heritage as well. My mom from a family of 13. And, you know, it just felt so cool how you really dug into your family's recipes and the roots to really understand how they were affecting food culture. What was the aha moment there for you?
I mean, I think the aha moment was years ago when my brother, Brett, my older brother, Brett, he's a year older than me, and dad were sitting out on the porch one summer and just talking about life on the farm where dad grew up. And grandma had a huge kitchen garden and canned all of these things. And grandpa had a smokehouse. He was a tomato farmer by trade. He sold into the Red Gold Co-op. That was how they got their cash money. But he started talking about the wine, the wild cherry and blackberry wine that grandpa would make. And it really lit up a light bulb in my head, because it was something that I remembered seeing on those wooden ricks in the basement when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. This wine, and grandpa would, it turns out, make it in huge quantities. He made it in a whiskey barrel. And I just thought to myself, wow, I've really got to, you know, tell me that again, Dad, and let me turn on the recorder on my phone and start recording and remembering these things.
You dedicate this book to the women of the greater Midwest. Why is that?
Because I think, and you know, probably all women would know this, and hopefully increasingly more men know that women have always kind of had a thankless role in society that people just take for granted. Certainly in the culture I grew up in, mom worked incredibly hard, and both of my grandmas worked incredibly hard taking care of their families. Everything from, you know, showing the kids how to tie their shoes to making sure dinner was on the table, to making sure everybody was dressed properly and on time for school, really keeping the family together while, you know, and again, this is in sort of the old line traditional American culture that dad went off and earned the paycheck and mom stayed home and made sure the pulse of the home was running correctly. And I think that women just haven't really been thanked for that incredibly important role that they've played. I mean, everyone loves their mom. Hopefully everyone loves their mom. But I think that really a recognition of how important their work is in food, particularly in the case of this book, but in our culture, it's hard to overstate. And I don't think that it's been stated enough how important women's role is.
The modern populations of Wisconsin and other Midwestern states predominantly white. How are people of color affecting food in the Midwest?
Historically, mostly in the cities. And I think in Chicago and St. Louis, we have barbecue culture. There's some barbecue culture in Minneapolis and Detroit and Milwaukee as well. The cities tend to be where immigrants go and settle, you know. So right now we have a lot of Korean immigrants. We've had Chinese immigrants for a few generations now, Mexican immigrants that come in and sort of tinker with our food ways, sort of tinker with the things that are here, like the Italians did. The Germans were sort of part of the first wave when the cities were coming. So a lot of our food ways were, the foundations of them were on German cuisine, but the Italians came in and Mexican and Latino immigrants come in and sort of start tinkering with the food ways. And they don't really percolate out into the country until quite a bit later. I mean, I sort of experienced this growing up where, you know, these nationwide trends wouldn't make it to our small town until you know, 10 or in some cases 20 years later.
Took some time, yes. Chef Paul Fehrbach, author of Midwestern Food, paying tribute to our cuisine in the heartland and the influences of German ancestry, immigrants in dishes and drinks. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your insights along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Chicago chef Paul Fehrbach, who aims to give more credit to Midwestern food. I mean, come on. His new book captures recipes in their original form, and Paul studies the influences of immigrant communities and foods and how they inform what we cook up today in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Kathy in Maguanago. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I was telling the other young lady that when I grew up in Chippewa County in northern Wisconsin, German French heritage, and when we butchered a pig, my grandmother would take the head of the pig and put it in a big pot and boil it and for hours, and she would then make head cheese. And it was kind of solid. It was gray looking, but it was solid. Now I noticed in the store where you want to buy head cheese, it's got all this gelatin in it, which makes it unappetizing. But we loved it, and we had a conversation here in town about it, and everybody made faces about it. But it was good food back then.
Kathy, thank you for that remembrance. Paul, go ahead.
I love head cheese, and she's absolutely right that the supermarket version of it is kind of odd and doesn't really resemble what we would know in home cooking. And my grandma would make head cheese from the head of the pig when grandpa would do the hog killings, and the men would make the sausages and all of that. Everybody had their role. But when I started seeing head cheese in grocery stores, it's like these little bits of snout and ear and all of that suspended in this clear aspic or gelatin, and it never looked appetizing to me, but apparently somebody's buying it because they continue to sell it in the store. I like the traditional one where it's just kind of boiled and eventually it's kind of gray, but it's really rich. If you like the taste of pork, it's as porky as it gets.
Not quite the transition, but you do have the recipe for cold pack cheese or squeeze cheese. What's the story behind that?
There was a lot of legends about where cold pack cheese came from. And because it can be a little bit murky, a lot of these stories, but I did eventually find a reference to the Scandinavian practice of preserving bits and pieces of cheese in either aquavit or beer by blending it all together. So, you know, you have little scraps of cheese left over and you want to preserve it. So you add a little alcohol and beat it until it's all in there. And so that would sort of dovetail on the timeline of when Scandinavian immigrants started to come to Wisconsin in the 1890s or so, and in the early 1900s is when crock cheese appears, and Pine River Dairy, I think, was the first to make a brand for the market, and Kokana, I think, was the original brand. They work out of Pine River Dairy. They're twin labels. And it's, you know, I grew up with it. I absolutely love it. A lot of people think it's weird because it's cheese you can spread. But if you know what cold pack cheese is, it's just two or more cheeses that are blended together without heat. So it's cheese, and but you can spread it. I mean, I can't think of anything better.
Turning to beer, because over the last decade, the microbrewery scene in America has just boomed. And in 2020, the Brewers Association says there were over 2,500 craft breweries throughout the Midwest. Why are craft beers a popular drink in the Midwest?
Well, I mean, I think there is a lot of German heritage here. It is, for one, Irish, Polish, Scandinavian, all of these cultures like drinking beer. And so it's natural for people to want a different taste. When I was growing up, there were a handful of beer brands that you could find in the grocery store, you know, as of the 1970s, because all of the breweries that did exist before Prohibition, most of them stopped existing during Prohibition. So there used to be a lot of breweries around town. My hometown of Jasper, Indiana, had three breweries on the cusp of Prohibition and didn't have another one until the 1990s, when somebody decided to start brewing beer and, you know, started a little brew house. And that's sort of the movement. It's sort of a reclamation, I think, of that heritage of having a brewery in your town. And so you also get a lot more different flavors and types of beer that way. And people like variety. And I think that that has a lot to do with what's fueling it.
And toward the beginning of the 1900s, your research says fewer home brewing beer recipes were appearing in cookbooks. And you attribute that trend to the rise in commercial breweries. What kinds of things were coming out of cookbooks? What kind of beer were people brewing at home?
Oh, there were some really wild recipes in the 19th century. I mean, one of them was nothing but molasses and hops boiled together and then fermented. Lettuce Bryan, in this cookbook called The Kentucky Housewife, which was actually published in Cincinnati. But with the westward migration of people during the 19th century, it was a really important book in the Midwest as well. She has recipes for London Porter in there. She has recipes for India Pale Ale. And some of these recipes would be extremely elaborate. You think nowadays, you think of beer as being malt and hops and yeast, and then you ferment it and then you have beer. But a lot of these would have, you know, yeah, molasses was a common ingredient, different spices. Some of them would have, you know, medicinal things added to it. Just a really wild variety. The one thing you did never saw in these home cookbooks, though, was recipes for lager beers, which are what would eventually become the commercial standard. And because lager is a difficult thing to brew, and you just couldn't do it at home back then.
Paul Fehrbach, as we talk about Midwestern food, author and chef, you can join in the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234 to ask a question, share your comments about Midwestern cuisine. Let's go to Paul in Hurley. Paul, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My story is I grew up in Racine, a very German family. And I just had my mother and three sisters up here visiting, and we decided to make a family recipe, potato pancakes. And my father showed me how to do that. It's grated potatoes with some bread added, no egg, no flours added. And one of the secrets is to mix it for like 10 minutes to get the consistency correct. And it turned out wonderfully. I hadn't made it in like 5 years, but I was real happy with the result again.
How did you dress the potato pancakes?
Oh, living in Hurley, I have access to maple trees. So homemade maple syrup, fresh applesauce from apples picked that same day. It was wonderful.
Oh, wow, that is so fabulous. Oh, Paul from Hurley, thank you so much. Paul Fehrbach, what do you make of the potato pancakes?
That sounds fantastic. And it there's great apples in Wisconsin now, too. So good call there. Potato pancakes are really important in Wisconsin. And actually, in the fish fry culture, you see potato pancakes pop up a lot, whereas almost everywhere else, you know, fried fish nowadays, they serve with French fries. It's a very sort of rote or standard thing nowadays. But a lot of Wisconsin fish fries will actually advertise that they have potato pancakes because people are looking for these. The recipe that Paul described with broken up bread and mixing it together, that's a really rare kind of recipe and a particularly delicious one because bread brings an extra sort of toasty flavor to it, which the toast, that toasty caramelized flavor is one of the things we like about potato pancakes, and bread brings a whole other dimension to that.
I laughed when you wrote that there are probably as many recipes for fried fish as there are cooks in Wisconsin. Why do you think that is?
Because recipes and food are very personal. And, you know, I never liked beer batter. As an adult, I have kind of taken to it a little bit more. I think it was maybe because I wasn't using good beer before, or using the wrong kind of beer. If you take an IPA and mix it into a beer batter, all you're going to taste is hops by the time you fry something. I like to use hard cider more than I like to use beer for batters. Some people don't like either and would just use club soda. Some people don't like the sort of the airiness that brings to the batter, so they just use water or milk to make their batter. Some people use eggs because they like the richness. To me, eggs make it more, make a batter that doesn't cook as crisp. So, and some people like to dry dredge fish, which for me, it depends on how thick the fillet is. Really thin fish fillets, something like bluegill or younger whitefish or trout, I like to just bread. Whereas thicker fish fillets, cod, larger whitefish, I think are better batter fried, but everybody has their preference. And so in every household, you're going to have a different approach to frying fish.
Chef Paul Fehrbach's book, it's called Midwestern Food, and he studies the archives of recipes, how they evolved through generations, becoming memorable to Wisconsin and the Midwest. Call in at any point with a question. You can share your perspectives and memories, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we talk about Midwestern food, don't miss this week's edition of Food Friday on Central Time. We explore using apples in the kitchen with the owner of the Ugly Apple Cafe in Madison, and that's Central Time after 3. Now we have Chicago-based chef Paul Fehrbach, who reads old cookbooks to trace the origin stories of Midwest cuisine and how recipes came to be. Join this discussion with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. We have Randy in Ripon now. Hi, Randy.
Well, good morning. I grew up around farming here. And my mom's parents were German, and all the family was farmers. And I just remember the meals with the casseroles or pot roast or pork roast. And then Grandma used to make these raised donuts, like a yeast raised donut. And I found a place in Madison. Of course, it's no longer there, but the recipe must have been identical to my grandmother's because it was almost sourdough-like. But all these things like German potato salad, I've never found anybody that made German potato salad as good as she did. But to me, that stuff seems exotic now. It's hard to come by.
It's hard to come by in the form that you remember it. Is that right?
Well, in restaurants just don't. I mean, some try, but, you know, everybody wants sushi or whatever, you know, hot and spicy stuff. And I love that food, and I long for it. Just the memories.
Oh, Randy, thank you so much. Paul, you know, from the yeast-raised donuts to the German potato salad, it's just hard to find out there in the same way.
Yeah, I definitely sympathize with Randy about all of these foods, and it's, you know, some of that is the inspiration for why I wrote this book. I wanted to write down some of these recipes and document them because food ways change. It's true that, like, now a youngster might experience ramen before they've had, you know, chicken and noodles. or chicken and dumplings. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I think we also need to value our food a little bit more, our traditional foods, and cook them a little bit more often, because I think certainly for me growing up, I took them for granted. And when I grew up as an adult, I didn't want to eat them as much because I wanted to try new things. But the problem is that if we don't eat them, if we don't eat that traditional German potato salad, or if we don't eat, you know, the hot potato salad, or if we don't make raised yeast donuts at home, you know, those arts get lost. And I wanted to document as many of them as I could in this book, and also encourage people to revisit them and to cook them more often, because they are really delicious.
Let's bring in Carol in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Carol. What's on your mind?
Well, apple dumplings are on my mind. I wonder if he's found that recipe or is familiar with it. My mom was German. I grew up in northwestern Illinois, and apple dumplings this time of year was a favorite. So I just was curious if he was familiar with apple dumplings.
Carol, thanks. Paul?
Apple dumplings are actually the first recipe that I learned how to cook. And they didn't make it into the book. Unfortunately, there's such a diversity of foods in the Midwest. We could only include about 100 recipes. In second grade, I actually had a crush on my teacher, Mrs. Bloomy. And she said one day in class that she loved apple dumplings. And so I went home and told mom that I had to make apple dumplings. And mom, of course, I had just the best mom. And so we went to the store and we got some apples, and we made apple dumplings. And the next day I took them to school for Mrs. Bloomy. She was quite surprised. But mom had made them many times. Mom wasn't of a German background, but she learned them from my dad's mom, who was one of these German American women she never spoke a lick of English in her life, because that community was so populated by people from the German state of Baden. Most of the older people there never even learned how to speak English, but she'd learned how to make apple dumplings, and I went home and I had to make apple dumplings, and that was in second grade the first recipe I learned how to make.
Oh, what a memory. Carol, thank you so much for bringing that up. Let's go to Barbara in Grand Marsh. Barbara, hi.
Hello. My mother made the best potato pancakes. Today, when you go to the restaurant, they use shredded potatoes. My mother grated her potatoes and grated the onions. They were thin and lacy on the edges.
Thin and lacy on the edges. Can you replicate them today, Barbara?
I've tried, but I don't know. Maybe I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Maybe it's the kind of potatoes. I don't remember what kind of potatoes she used. And I know I didn't think there was any egg in it either.
Paul, any clues?
You might try the recipe that's in the book, which has one or two eggs in it, but you can make them without. There's a Swiss recipe, and I think where a lot of these potato pancake recipes come from is the very, very southwestern part of Germany, Switzerland, Baden, Swabia. You get potato pancakes all over Germany and the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. But there's a particular kind called rosti, which you find, or look for some rosti recipes, which are from Switzerland, you know, the German-speaking part of Switzerland in the very, very southwestern corner of Germany, where it's really basically just shredded potatoes cooked in schmaltz, cooked in hot fat. And then schmaltz in German could be pork fat, chicken fat, beef fat, any kind of rendered fat. If you're Jewish, it usually means poultry fat. But they're fantastic. It's my favorite way to make them, actually, again, is without any egg at all, because just like with beer batter or with a fish batter, the egg, it adds richness, but it can hold your pancake together, but the potatoes have plenty of starch. They don't need the eggs to hold them together, but the eggs can also make it more spongy and soft. And if you really like those lacy, crunchy edges, don't put any egg in it. I would say the one potato you might look for At a farmer's market, if you can, because you're not going to find them at the grocery store, is called a German butterball. It's a starchy potato, okay, similar to a russet, but they're much smaller. And you can grate those, and they make fantastic roasty.
We need to make some space here for the Kringle, Wisconsin's official state pastry. Yearbook, you have a Chicago hearty fig version, and we have that recipe over at WPR.org/mornings. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, Kringles, they're obviously Danish in heritage, and I just love them. And I think I didn't get to Racine until maybe 7 or 8 years ago for the first time. And it was one of the towns that sort of made me realize I've got to do this book. Because at the time, the book was going to be more about the Ohio River Valley's food and my family's food. And I visited Racine, and on the recommendation of a friend, I went to Wells Brothers and got pizza. And I went to Benson's, and I went to O&H. And Benson's has a really good Seven Sisters, which is another traditional Danish pastry as well. But I, you know, loaded up on Kringles, went to Kewpie Lunch. I usually wind up having like two lunches when I go to, or three lunches when I go to Racine. And it was one of the towns that made me realize I've got to do this book about the Midwest and not just about, you know, my hometown and about my family, because there's such a great story there. And there's Danish immigrants in different parts of the U.S., and why the Kringle only stuck in Racine is a really good question, but that it's such a delicious pastry that we're lucky to have. And, you know, the Midwest is lucky to have Racine as one of our towns where we can go and get Kringles and absolutely, in my mind, the best tavern style pizza that exists on earth.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I guess it was, I mean, that's a showstopper there, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for taking us on this tour. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun. And thanks to everyone who called in.
Paul Fehrbach, author of Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. And there are recipes to check out from the book, including beer brats and that fig Kringle. Find them on our program page at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers at UW-Eau Claire expand their work at points around the globe and here in Wisconsin using ground-penetrating radar to identify potential unmarked mass graves. And in countries like Lithuania, it helps to locate where atrocities occurred in the Holocaust. You can call in with a question. You can share perspectives at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harry Joel is a professor of geography and anthropology at UW-Eau Claire. Harry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the interest.
So for years, you have helped locate remains buried decades earlier in Wisconsin and across the world, and you use Pulse Echo, this commercially available deep ground penetrating radar equipment. How did you come to use this technology for finding unmarked burial sites?
Originally the technology was developed during the Apollo missions to land on the moon. And it's interesting, we're going back to the moon. But as soon as I started using this equipment, there's always an interest of locating unmarked grave sites. And even within cemeteries or out in fields in different locations. And so we've done it from an archaeological sense, such as Israel, where grave sites can be thousands of years old, all the way to places like the Holocaust and even within our own within Wisconsin, Potter Fields.
You know, you've been using this technology for 3 decades in your research. Has it evolved? Has it improved?
The electronics have improved. Back when I was starting it, a lot of it was analog. And we got some of the first digital systems out there. And so from an electronics point of view, just like, you know, laptops were developed at the same time, these radar systems were. And so we've seen laptops get smaller and smaller. And now we have smartphones. And now you can actually run some of the radar systems from smartphones.
Wow. I'm trying to think of something analogous in my life. Like, you know, is ground penetrating radar like having an ultrasound in a doctor's office? Like, just though that this is like high frequency radio waves looking into the ground to form images. Would that be some analogous?
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing in the electromagnetic spectrum, like you mentioned, the radio waves. So we're talking, you know, Claire here is, you know, 88.3. That is the electromagnetic frequency that we put into the ground at the same idea. When we go to the hospital, we're getting a variety of different imaging into our bodies, and we're using the same algorithms. You were talking about AI last hour. So that AI is doing some of that interpretation at the hospital, as well as on computer screens, as well as all the whole gaming industry is using the same algorithms.
This technology can give you glimpses of what may be underneath the surface without disturbing the ground. How is this an advantage when searching for unmarked graves?
Looking for graves is often a sensitive issue in a lot of different cultures. When we work with Native populations, First Nations from Canada, and then as we move into such as the Holocaust work, using Jewish law, Holocaust, the idea that this tragedy has already happened, we're not going to excavate to cause another tragedy. While other cultures, such as Christian cultures and Muslim cultures that we've worked with, the idea of finding the bodies, excavating them, and repatriate them to the families becomes important.
Harry Joel is with us, UW Eau Claire Professor of Geography and Anthropology, as we talk about the technology used to locate unmarked grave sites. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Last month, you returned from Cyprus, the island nation in the Mediterranean. Hundreds of Greek and Turkish Cypriots disappeared in clashes in the 60s and during the 1974 Turkish invasion. How were you able to assist in the search for victims?
They're part of a network, but the Committee for Missing Persons in Cyprus uses bilateral. So you have Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots that work together and that we work with, and there's sites that are identified by survivors or by witnesses who said somewhere over there I saw the killing, or I know the killing took place over there. And often these sites are so large that you can't just excavate the whole field. And so our job is to try to narrow that in, and if we can, identify potential sites for excavation. They have like 7 to 8 excavation crews going every single day, and they're trying to locate and repatriate these bones, anthropological analysis, forensic science. I've worked with a lot of different teams. This is probably the most well-tuned and well-oiled machine of trying to locate missing persons due to past conflicts.
I wonder, how do countries or commissions contact you for a potential scan project?
We've done a lot of projects, been on have different news sources that have covered our work, as well as publications by myself and my students. We've done a lot of work, and I try to encourage the students to publish at conferences and publish papers if they're so interested. We're at Eau Claire, we're an undergraduate institute, so we're not working with graduate students, and so we've worked with a variety of different institutes, and so doing searches, or I've met them at conferences, or just by word of mouth of, you know, I've worked with Harry at here, that may be a potential location. And so I try to run a lot of workshops for these organizations, because I really want to work myself out of a job. I want this to be done by the country or the organization within the country.
I want to work myself out of a job. That's so interesting. And, you know, you worked with the Cyprus Committee on Missing Persons, as you mentioned. How difficult is your work in disputed areas where national animosities are still present?
We work with that bilateral committee and bilateral people in the field. And I don't feel that. There's still some animosity that's mm-hmm. there, but with the people I'm working with and their connections with their local populations, everything has been very positive in the field. And it's actually been impressive to see understanding of what, let's say, the world looks at this like versus being on the ground. We're working with the United Nations there, so that allows us to get in and out and through the borders with the equipment. And both sides are very, very well connected and allows us to move smoothly to get to these sites. Even at the airport, as we're leaving, they said, oh, you're part of the team with Committee for Missing Persons because they know this is happening in the country. Everyone knows.
Wow. Well, what happens after you've finished your investigation at a site? You know, what are the steps after that?
So what we meet with the members. There's three members of the committee, and one is from the Turkish Cypriot side, one's from the Greek Cypriot side, and one's from the United Nations through the International Red Cross. And we give our reports verbally and talk about those. They make decisions almost on the spot of where they're going to excavate. So the teams then would excavate, provide reports. If bodies are found, those are passed to the anthropological lab. A complete assessment is done. Samples are sent for DNA to a lab in the United States. And then that results is tried to link up with family members, brothers, sisters, wives, parents, things like that. And then the bones through social workers and psychologists work with the families, as well as imams and priests to return the bodies for burial.
Harry Joel is a geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire. As we explore this work using deep ground penetrating radar to help locate buried human remains, call in to share your thoughts. You can ask a question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how ground-penetrating radar technology is used to detect possible unmarked graves in Wisconsin and sites across the globe. You can call in with a question, share thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. This research at UW-Eau Claire is led by Harry Joel, a geography and anthropology professor. We are also joined by one of Harry Joel's undergraduate students, Sasha Kavaznik, who is a geography major. Sasha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you. I'm really excited to be here today.
So in July, you were among a group of Harry students investigating suspected mass graves of Holocaust victims in Latvia and Lithuania. And I understand your great-great-grandmother grew up in a Lithuanian village where hundreds of Jews were massacred. How did you process that history as you took part in this project?
Yeah, it was a pretty intense experience for me. So I'm a conservative Jew. I grew up in St. Paul in the Twin Cities. And yes, I'm the fourth generation in the United States. And growing up, I learned about the Holocaust, but my parents didn't really talk about it. And so I had no idea when we got there that these locations would be truly unmarked. I mean, they were public beaches, public parks. Some were cemeteries that had graves that were unmarked, but people were walking around enjoying their day with no idea that they were potentially standing on these mass graves.
What was your role in the project? What were your days like?
Yeah, our days were long. We got going every morning pretty early, and we were out in the field all day obtaining data, honestly, as much as we could gather. You know, we were only going to be in these places just for either a couple of days and definitely just some of these places just this one time. So trying to obtain information not only for the communities you know, the Jewish communities in the United States, but also the Jewish communities that exist in these towns, and providing information for potentially representing the Lithuanian collaboration that occurred during the Holocaust, acting as public reminders, placing memorials in these different countries.
Hmm. You talked about different terrain that you were scanning and using this technology on. Did you, I'm just wondering, did you have to like ensure that there you weren't working in fields where you couldn't, you'd have to deal with the, you know, any types of barriers in the environment? Or could you scan like anywhere, concrete, grass, forest? What about the terrain?
Yeah. So what's so amazing about the tools that we were using is you can use them in all different types of landscapes and environments. So we were able to use these tools at a beach, a public beach, where there were sand dunes. We were on the Baltic Sea. We were able to obtain information there. We were also, again, able to obtain information in the forest, locations that maybe had a rock that symbolized the people that were murdered in that place, but no other true evidence, no science to back up these eyewitness testimonies.
Hmm. Your great-great-grandmother, as you said, didn't talk much about life prior to emigrating to the United States. How did your family understand its history in Lithuania?
Yeah, so this trip honestly unmasked a lot of my ancestral history. I got a hold of my family tree, and that was how I found out that Rebecca, my great-great-grandma, was from Lithuania. And while we were in one of the towns called Shaduva, I had received a message that I potentially had family from that small town. In the early 1900s, there was about 2,500 Jewish people in this town. And right before the Holocaust, there was 700, and they were all executed in just a matter of a couple of days. So I was running up and down the cemetery. All the tombstones were written in Yiddish and in Hebrew and had been wiped away, and many of them destroyed. And so it was really an incredible experience for me to be in this place where my family potentially was from, and to learn about it in person, because you can only read so much in a book or learn about things in a classroom. To physically be there and be retracing the steps of my ancestors was unreal for me.
Wow. I would imagine you took a lot of pictures of any markers that existed.
Oh, I am a photographer. I love to take pictures. My grandpa, Walter Kovaznik, was a really well-known photographer in the St. Paul area, mm-hmm. did a lot of weddings, lots of Jewish weddings, graduation pictures, you name it. And so I have just always been really passionate about photography. I probably took over 150 pictures at every site we went to.
Mm. We're talking with UW-Eau Claire geography major Sasha Kovaznik as we look at studying burial sites around the world. Harry Joel with us, UW-Eau Claire professor of geography and anthropology. Harry, your largest project has involved searching for mass graves of Jews killed in the Holocaust. Why involve students in these investigations?
I'm a strong believer in fieldwork as a transformative learning experience for students. And you could go back for 30 years of students who's been in the field. I still get emails from students every year who've been in the field and saying how transformative that was, and allowed them to pursue careers that they never thought they could, just because of the confidence they've gained. But I also think the field is also a place where you meet with people and you gain relationships very, very quickly. And these are your future, you could say, partners, future business partners, future people that you're going to come in contact with. And we're also solving problems for in-country partners. And so they realize that this is not something it's just for here. You are also passing the data on to the local communities.
I think about your two titles as geography and anthropology, and I'm just curious why you think it might be important for anthropologists to use this geophysical surveying method.
Well, I think within the geosciences, we have a lot of different tools, and I think it becomes more and more important that we use these tools cross-disciplinary. And a lot of the people I work with, you know, are in history or in different fields, and they often are not aware of these tools or what these tools can do. And so I'm trained as a physical geographer, looking at coastal systems. I love Lake Superior. That's where I love to go work. But some of this work is you could say more important, because where it's cross-disciplinary and working with these community groups that are still looking to solve problems that are, you know, decades old, hundreds of years old, thousands of years old.
Sasha, there are local efforts in Eastern Europe to put up memorials honoring Jewish victims where they were buried. What value do you see in historic markers and memorials at these sites?
Yeah, so I think memorials can not only be a reminder for people and tourism, for people to come visit these locations in which potentially their families were murdered, but also to help educate the communities that surround these memorials, you know, to teach the generations that these events did occur and we should memorialize these graves, to teach the next generations, because by ignoring these difficult topics, by not memorializing the dead, what are we teaching those next generations? We're risking that the Holocaust could reoccur.
Hmm. And this month you plan to share the research you did in Eastern Europe at a conference. You know, what are some central things you want to share and convey?
Yeah, I am very excited to be going to a conference. I will be giving an oral presentation at GSA Connects 2023 in Pittsburgh. And I'm hoping just to spread awareness and educate people about Judaism, about how you can use geophysics to identify Jewish mass graves, and how potentially people could use those techniques globally to identify other graves, help teach about, again, those tragic histories that are so difficult to teach about.
You anticipate to graduate from UW-Eau Claire this semester with a Bachelor's of Science in Geography and a minor in Biology. What could I ask? What do you hope comes next?
Oh my gosh, that is a loaded question.
On the radio, no less.
Yes, I am interested in so many different topics. Mostly, I love to make maps. So this project really tapped into my cartography skills, my mapping skills, just that relationship between people, space, and place. I also am very passionate about the relationship we have with animals. So I'm not really sure what direction I'm going to go in. Conservation work, it could be Holocaust work. You know, I really don't know quite yet.
Wow. So many skills. It seems quite wide open there. Sasha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Sasha Kovaznik, who studies geography and biology at UW-Eau Claire. Harry Joel is a UW-Eau Claire professor of geography and anthropology, stays with us for more conversation about the breakthroughs in ground-penetrating radar. You can be part of the discussion along the way. Call in with a question. You can bring your comments. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ground-penetrating radar is a technology behind the identification of unmarked burial sites from Latvia and Lithuania in the Holocaust, to clashes on the island of Cyprus decades ago, to here in America on the grounds of former Native American boarding schools. You can join in the conversation, call in with a question, add your viewpoints. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harry Joel is a UW-Eau Claire geography and anthropology professor leading research that uses ground-penetrating radar, and stays with us. Let's bring in Eugene now in Biola. Eugene, hi.
Good morning. We have a part of the village here across the river that's called Mound Park. There were Indian mounds there, and the early settlers built on them or next to them 150 years ago, and it's never been excavated, to my knowledge anyways. If there would be an interest, then you could get a hold of the village office.
Eugene, thank you. Harry, how are you working with local tribes?
We've been doing workshops, and then we've also been out to different sites where we have an ask. We don't go to sites without that invitation, and we've often go through ceremony just so that the ancestors know we're going to be working in the area. And it's often trying to locate potential sites. And then if there's going to be development in the region, or if they want to, you know, just say, okay, this is the region we're going to put a fence around. When we've worked with Maori populations, that's often what's happened is a fence goes around that area. And then, you know, there's continuing of, let's say, sheep going through the area or things like that. But by invitation, looking at these sites is often the way we proceed and say, okay, what is of interest? What could radar do? What are other tools that could be done at that area as well?
You have consulted with Native American tribes to locate grave sites, and that work includes boarding schools here in the United States and in Canada where children are believed to be buried. How important to tribes is knowing what became of their people?
I would think there's, you know, there's a running theme through this work. It's people wanting to know where their ancestors are and to, you could say, memorialize them, identify these areas, these locations, to prevent any future development, as we've seen at some sites, and or just to have a place for families to go to acknowledge and mourn the loss of their ancestors. And so radar is one of these tools that could help identify there. And it's, you know, it's a tool, not the tool that can be used. And I think we need to have a suite of tools to be able to take a look at these and use these tools properly. And that's part of why I like to run, well, try to get workshops and say what can and cannot be done as we move forward. Because the realization is that many tribes in both the U.S. and Canada have their own radar systems. It's a matter of, just like many companies, you lose those employees, or those tribe members become employees in other sections, and we lose that skill set.
What are some of the complementary tools, as you say, you know, that would go in tandem with ground penetrating radar?
In this country, as well as other countries, we have a suite of aerial photos, so you can see when the ground has been disturbed. And sometimes these photos are taken yearly. We know that when over years, the ground will often sink as the body decomposes. And we often have to think, okay, what's happening during this process? And then, you know, in modern day cemeteries, they put soil down and then more grass on top. Well, you can see that if you use some tools like LIDAR. A lot of places in the United States have LIDAR coverage with high enough resolution. You can see these depressions. Other tools, people get buried with items. And so magnetics can be used, electrical resistivity tomography. And so there's a suite of tools that we can use to do a lot of this type of work.
I wonder about, like, tree roots and animal holes burrowing down. I mean, those can disturb the soil as well. How do you decipher soil that has been altered by people?
And this is the very difficult problem, is that in the press and a lot of other areas, is this idea that every potential image of a burial is a burial. And I hesitate to do that. I take a look at it as trained as a physical geographer, is if it's in a coastline, it should have coastal layering. And then if you disturb that layering, then that's more likely to be a burial than a rock or a tree root. But in many locations here in the Midwest, we have a lot of, you know, rocks left over from the glaciers. And then we also have tree roots, and those have been interpreted as burials when they're not.
With ground penetrating radar, Native American graves were discovered under a church parking lot on the Lac des Flambeaux Reservation in northern Wisconsin. The church has agreed to remove a building and restore the burial site. How often does that happen after a burial site is discovered?
I mean, that's happening, I think, as we, you know, as a conversation, do we, certain cultures accept the idea of their ancestors to be, you know, the bones to be repatriated, to be excavated. Other cultures do not. And so that has to, and certain tribes, First Nations that I've worked with, some will and some will not. We had up in Manitoba where they excavated several anomalies as well. And did not discover bones at those sites, and other sites they are finding bones. It's this trying to get this skill set. This is a relatively new field, and trying to get that better and better as we go forward.
I wonder your approach to scanning a site when you do see mounds that are visual that you can see on the landscape versus a site, a large site, where there are no visible clues on the landscape. Do you approach those in different ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think the higher the resolution or the tighter the lines, because what we do is basically put a whole bunch of lines together and then put that into a 3D cube. It's almost like gaming. And then you can go into that cube and take a look for features, because not all mounds have burials in them. We looked at several mounds that don't have, you know, they can be built for other purposes, effigy mounds and things like that. And so same thing as when we're looking for burials in a potential field, the more we know, the better. But to do a big, let's say, soccer field is going to take weeks and weeks of data collection. And so to get the right resolution that you need. And I often put it to, like, if you go imaging at the hospital, do you only want, you know, part of your body imaged? Or if it's a whole body, it's going to take a lot longer. And you want it at high resolution, so it's even going to take longer. And so we got to make sure we collect the data to be able to interpret what we are looking for.
Harry Joel is with us, UW Eau Claire Professor of Geography and Anthropology, as we explore his research locating unmarked burial sites and using ground-penetrating radar. You can join in with your questions. You can share your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. Harry, you've used radar in existing cemeteries. When is more information needed about where graves are located inside cemeteries?
In our present-day cemeteries, with a lot of them filling up, there are people in the past who have bought, let's say, two or three plots for family members, and those family members have been buried elsewhere. So there's two or three empty plots, but they don't know by records or records lost if someone else was buried at that site or not. Or I've been in examples where a certain individual wanted to be buried with their horse. So the horse was buried next to them. And now they would like that spot to be able to use for, you know, other individuals to be buried. And so it's trying to find where those sites are.
You're doing this work on a potter's field in Dunn County. What is a potter's field?
So this is something I did not know about. And the potter's field is where people at that time, what we would call an insane asylum, where people were coming back off, you know, world wars. What would today we would call PTSD, or other people in those institutes where family members would have basically said, you're in the institute, those individuals die, they have no family support, and they get buried in this field near the asylum. I mean, Laura Ingalls Annett was buried in this one. So there's a lot of different individuals. And then as well in Dunn County, the poorhouse was right on the other side. And so you have individuals buried in the potter's field, both from the poorhouse and from the asylum.
What does your project entail in that situation? What are you trying to do?
Well, it's multipurpose. We, again, were asked by the local community to come in. And Sophie and Dave have encouraged us to work at this site. We've had several student projects to work at this site. And to go training, and we're going to go in a week and a half to go up there, and it's all new students who take a look at how do we collect data and how do we get that through, and then they'll work through that data through the next year and then present it at our annual student conference with the results. And then those results go back to the community, and then the idea is to put markers on the graves that we know are there.
How do you train up students who've never encountered this technology, never encountered this work? What is that training like?
We do there's some readings. I've tried to, with a colleague, write a, like an intro what is ground penetrating radar, and then most of it is hands-on. I really think getting out into the field, getting the equipment into the students' hands, getting them up and running. From a tech point of view, they're very tech savvy. It's now, well, how do we collect data from a scientific point of view, and how do you collect it correctly and setting it up and taking that time? And then it's basically time in the field, as Sasha was mentioning, long days in the field collecting the data and then start processing it at night.
Are there particular skill sets that students who succeed at this work have?
I think an interest and in wanting to step out of your comfort zone. So the students on my teams are not just geography students. I mean, we've had religious studies, we've had, you know, secondary education, we've had special ed, we've had students in geology, we've had students in biology. So it's students of interest. And I just, in all my classes, I do a short 20-minute talk on the Holocaust and the work we're doing. And I said, if you're interested, come see me. And that's often, you know, some of those students are the ones that join the team and join.
The jumping off point. Harry Joel, geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire. You can call in to ask a question. You can share your insights at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Eau Claire geography and anthropology professor Harry Joel, who has been using ground-penetrating radar at over 1,200 sites across the world through decades of research projects identifying unmarked burial sites, sites of atrocities. Call in to bring up your question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harry, looking to the future, this technology is commercially available. You mentioned our phones and our pockets also becoming much more powerful. And then AI, how is artificial intelligence potentially contributing to this work and this field of geosurveying?
I think a lot of it is, you know, the visualization tools that we use. I mean, AI is being used at the hospitals for that visualization after you image, you know, a body. We're doing the same thing in the ground. So when we're collecting this data in the ground, how can we have this technology be able to figure out, okay, is this a tree root? Is this a rock? Is this a burial? What kind of rules can we put in place to try to help make those interpretations?
Is concrete at all an issue for you, or when you don't have that natural ground and you have layers of concrete or other materials, can you still do this type of work?
Yeah, I mean, concrete, all our highways in the United States are imaged by ground penetrating radar to figure out if they're weathering or if there's voids underneath. And so often we'll see highways only ripped apart in sections. Not the whole highway. And so that's some of the radar and other thermal imaging that be able to identify those sites. And so we can see things underneath. We could also look at rebarb. So look at bridge decking and things like that. We could figure out exactly where that rebarb is and see what the problems are. And so it can be used for a lot of infrastructure work. I don't do a lot of that work, but it's being used a lot to do that. So we do image on top of parking lots to look for things underneath.
You mentioned also coastal systems, and, you know, I'm wondering, you know, and how lake water rises causes erosion. How can this technology you're using, you know, to find burial sites also be used to find solutions to environmental problems?
So we've used it for many years, everything from, as you mentioned, take a look at lake level changes. And I use Lake Superior as a laboratory for what's happening to sea level rise in Florida and North Carolina and the West Coast. I'm taking a group of students out to the Pacific Northwest in 2 weeks on a field seminar, and we're going to be taking a look at earthquakes, what earthquakes do to coastlines, and then those potential tsunamis that have come inland. And we've imaged all that. We've imaged 9 earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, and we know exactly what happened in the Pacific Northwest during that time period. So we can start using this. We've used it, you know, in China, and we've used also in different New Zealand, Australia. So taking a look at different coastlines around the world is an important thing for the future.
What with these images, what type of story could they tell about coastlines?
So an example of up on the Duluth Barrier System, where we are having erosion happening during high water, we can take a look at this system and seeing how much it's prograded or built out over the last couple thousand years, and try to figure out how that happened, when that happened, where did the sediment come from, as we urbanize some of these areas and prevent flow of sediment coming from the north or the south. And so we've seen some significant changes over the past 30 years that we've taken students up there.
I wonder, too, can it predict a bit about what the future holds in terms of sediment and any vision based on what you can see from the past?
Yeah, I'm working with a group, the Park Point Community Association, and that's some scientists and concerned community members. And we work with the Corps of Engineers and others, because we know that the Superior Duluth Harbor is a multi-billion dollar economic input into that area, and it brings a lot of resources into the Midwest. But on the other hand, the barrier system is eroding, so we need to protect that. And if we don't protect that, that harbor is gone.
Let's bring in Marianne in Madison. Hi, Marianne.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Doctor, I just wanted to thank you. It's especially poignant to me because today is Indigenous Peoples Day. I want to thank you for the work you're doing. I work with, I teach for Nobody Homicides, both internationally and nationally, and I know how much your work means to people from a modern perspective of people who've had family members going missing, and how much the ground penetrating radar can assist in getting people answers. So just as somebody in kind of a related field, I just want to give you my gratitude and thank you for what you and your students are doing. It's making a difference in the world.
Marianne, thank you for the call. Harry, how heavy is the responsibility you feel to interpret the readings diligently and carefully?
I mean, we take those, you know, very seriously. It's a matter of taking a look at these, putting in the context of the information we know from our in-country partners or what's happened in the past, those other tools that we talked about. And then as we move forward, things like environmental DNA is now possible. Work with a colleague down in Madison. And what are these steps we have to put together to try to put this, forward, to try to answer some of the questions that Marianne's put forward. I mean, the Bureau of Indian Affairs under earlier administration has now have a unit to take a look at this on tribal lands. And one of the tools that we've talked to them about that they have using now is radar, but also drones. Drone imagery can be amazing at some of these really remote locations that are large, and trying to pinpoint some of these locations for the more detailed work.
Let's bring in Joan in Superior. Joan, what is your question?
Well, I'm just wondering what kind of topography that you can use this in. I'm thinking of a cemetery in Douglas County that probably hasn't had a burial since the 1940s that is totally overgrown with huge, huge towering pine trees. And can you get into a place like that, or does it have to be a field compared to something out, you might as well say, in the middle of the woods?
Yeah, I mean, we've worked in all kinds of areas, Joan, and often if it's, you know, grass, we can go through it, or sometimes we'll trim it all down in those areas. We go in and around logs. Some of the sites, the Holocaust ones, are similar to what you're talking about, where nothing has been to the sites and you've had trees growing up in that area. And so we have to basically work up and around some of these trees, and hopefully we make notes of where those trees are, so we know if there are root-like features in the subsurface, we acclaim that to the roots themselves. But we also know that sometimes people will plant trees on top of bodies as a remembrance, as a memorial to that individual. So we got to take a look at it both ways.
So you don't need to clear topography in order to do the scans. You work around and through the topography.
Correct. We take laser leveling of all our sites. So we have a 3D map of each of our sites.
Oh, okay. Fascinating. Harry, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research.
Thank you. Thank you for the interest.
Harry Joel is a geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire. And earlier, we talked with UW-Eau Claire geography major Sasha Kovaznik. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can stream it. You can download a recording later today. Go to WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.